Hello everyone and welcome once again to Motos and Friends, the weekly podcast brought to you by the editors at Ultimate Motorcycling Magazine. My name is Arthur Coldwells. With its punchline ready to race, you have to take KTM seriously in the performance world. And so this week, editors Don Williams and Nick DeSena discuss the new KTM 990 Duke. Although in engine capacity terms it's almost a liter bike, actually the 990 Duke is classed as a middleweight. But having thrashed this beauty around the roads of southern Spain, Nick chats with Don and gives his reasons why this mid-sized beast is clearly punching above its weight. In the second segment this week, I have a really enjoyable chat with Richard Warsham. He's the co-founder and designer of the exquisite retro-style Janus motorcycles. Although manufactured in Goshen, Indiana with modern materials and using modern engines, the Janus range of bikes clearly harken back to a much simpler time. Richard admits that they can hardly be considered performance machines. So what exactly is it that makes these machines so darned attractive? Is it just the cool looks, or is there something else that's maybe not quite so obvious? Here's a quick reminder to leave us your comments on our social media. We're on all the usual platforms at Ultimate Motorcycling. We love hearing your feedback, so, good or bad, please let us know what you think. If there's something in particular you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear those ideas too. Anyway, from all of us here at Ultimate Motorcycling, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, this is Don Williams, editor of Ultimate Motorcycling, and I'm here with senior editor Nick DeSena, who has come back from a test of the new 2024 KTM 990 Duke. And let's see, KTM started out with a 690 Duke, and then they had a 790 Duke, and then they had an 890 Duke, and now they have a 990 Duke. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, so the displacements have grown and flipped around over the years, but the 690 was a single, so we're going to look at the history of the Dukes in more recent history that pertains to the parallel twin powered middleweight naked Dukes. And that began with the 790 Duke, which eventually paved the way for the 890 Dukes. And the 790s, we'll say, had a brief hiatus in their career. And now that the 990 Duke is here, the 890s have gone the way of the dodo, the 790s have returned, and that brings us to the 2024 KTM 990 Duke. So it is their, we'll say, flagship middleweight naked bike, competing with things like the Ducati Monster, the MT-09, Triumph Street Triple 765 RS, bikes of that ilk. And as you guys may have noticed, the middleweight category is becoming loosely middleweight, really stretching that definition of what middleweight is. But really, that's just to keep up with not only emissions standards, but performance goals in the face of those emission standards. So that's why we see the KTM 990 becoming a 947cc engine. But anyway, we had the opportunity to ride the 2024 KTM 990 Duke along with its siblings, the 390 and 1390, in Almeria, Spain recently. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So what do you want to talk about first?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind to me is the 990 now a liter bike? Because we're now into the, we went from the 790, which is obviously like a middleweight, but now 990 makes me think, well, that's only 10 away from 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be clear, it's not a true 990. KTM has always sort of gone with that numerical badging. There used to be a 990 long ago, but it wasn't actually a 990. Sometimes the displacement doesn't exactly match what's on the side of the bike. Ducati did this sort of thing too. So it's a 947cc engine. That said, you're not exactly all that far off from becoming a liter bike. However, is it a liter bike? No, because physically it's not the same size as, your average liter class naked machines. This is noticeably more compact and still feels like a middleweight in that regard. In terms of displacement, yeah, we're not too far off, which is, you know, why we were mentioning that, yeah, middleweight's a bit of a stretch. But that said, look at KTM's lineup for its naked Duke motorcycles, which has the Duke 200 as the absolute entry-level rung. You then have the 390, then the 790, the 990, and of course, the 1390. So even the 1390 got bigger this model year, essentially for the same reasons.
It's worth mentioning that they have three different engine configurations throughout the Duke line, from the singles at the bottom end to the parallel twins in the middle, and then the V-twin still sticks around at the top end.
Yeah. Yeah, and really, you can sort of categorize them in their in terms of their hierarchy, from single being the 200 and the 390. So those are going to be your entry-level naked bikes. Then, of course, you have the middleweight bikes found in the 790 and 990. Those are your parallel twin-powered motorcycles. And then you have the big 1390, which is still a V-twin, you know, classic, absolute, you know, stump-pulling motorcycle that is the 1390. Well, it's a lot more than that now. But we're going to focus on the 2024 KTM 990.
The 890 had various configurations. What does the 990, how does it fit into the previous 890 world?
Well, let's just focus on the two mainstream models, which you had a base model, which was just the 890 Duke, and then you had an 890 Duke R. And the R denotes sportier stuff, such as upgraded brakes and upgraded suspension, things of that matter. With the current 990, so the 2024 KTM 990 Duke, it is simply a 990 Duke. There is no R, there is no RS, there is no limited edition. It is just a 990 Duke. So does that mean there will be an R model in the future? Don't know, but the door is wide open, as we'll kind of explore later on with respect to a couple components that are on this bike. But as it stands, this is the one and only 990 Duke right now.
Okay, so, you know, the heart of any bike is going to be the motor. What is it like to ride the 990 motor?
It's very impressive. In fact, this is one of the things that sort of separates it. And when we were initially being introduced to the bikes by staff, they're pretty quick to point out that this update isn't about just building a bigger 890, because they could have done that. It was really about creating maybe a smaller 1390 Super Duke R, if that makes sense, because it's kind of a philosophical shift in how they're presenting and talking about this bike and the goals that they're trying to achieve with it. So it's not quite a leader class naked bike. And I would say maybe it's not as middleweighty as the 890 Duke and Duke R were. It's definitely got a more serious edge to it. And some of that starts with the engine, but perhaps not in the way you might think. Now, if you look at the numbers, the KTM 990 produces 123 horsepower and 76 foot-pounds of torque. So that's two additional horsepower and three additional foot-pounds of torque over the 890. And you're like, okay, well, that's not like worlds apart.
You're only going to notice that back-to-back.
Yeah, you know, in terms of like outright power. And even that would be pretty
tough to tell. For two horsepower is not a lot when you get into that much number.
But when they've extensively redesigned an engine, because essentially this is a 96% new motorcycle, according to staff. And, you know, that goes for an all new engine, all new chassis, et cetera, all new electronics package. They've gone ahead. It's new pistons, new crank, new connecting rods, new cams, new engine cases, new fueling systems, et cetera, It has a larger bore and longer stroke. So basically nothing is recyclable from engine to engine, because once you change those two measurements, well, nothing is going to work anymore. It's not a matter of like, oh, they just stroked it out, or oh, they did a little bit of reconfiguring here. It's like, no, this is straight up a different engine. And I would say it makes as big of a step in refinement that we witnessed from the 790 to the 890, if not a bigger one, because the main thing you're getting here isn't necessarily about peak horsepower. What you're getting with that 947 cc is something that has a broader power band overall. We're talking about an engine that just pulls from you know, 3,000 to 7,000 RPM, that is your happy, you know, your happy hunting grounds in terms of the RPM. And that is a huge playground to have, right? So the thing just has great torque. It's very inviting, but it still has that rowdiness that we've always known the Duke to have. So despite the fact that, you know, this thing is a light your hair on fire, do wheelies, and it's a very KTM engine in the sense that it spools up aggressively and has a lot of fight to it, it's also really livable, which is something that you couldn't necessarily claim to the same degree about the 790 and 890 in contrast to this. Those engines always worked well at low RPM, but this just feels meatier. It has more to it. The torque has more richness to it. There's more smoothness to it that the other engines just couldn't deliver. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're employing a similar strategy that we saw from the 790 into the 890, which was beefing up some of the internal components, adding a little bit of rotational inertia to that. On the 790 and the 890, the main component that received that was the crank. And that just kind of chilled the engine out a hair, kind of took that edge off. It also improved low end delivery and made it easier to ride at low RPM. And as we go to the 990 or the 947cc engine, you're seeing some of those same tricks of the trade go on here. And I think they pass with flying colors in terms of, you know, recycling some of those ideas. It's still that very ferocious, eager to lift the front end engine, but it's something that you can live with too. And it's easily a daily driver as much as it is just a canyon ripper I would love to take this thing to a track day because I really feel like it's hitting that sort of sweet spot in terms of performance and power delivery, which is right in that 120 horsepower zone. You know, we've said that about the super sport category, but I think this, you know, those same observations apply here as well. So if you're looking for the, you know, the nerdy stuff with the updates, like I said before, new pistons and crank cams, timing, it's got a new radiator, larger radiator, just to deal with the fact that we have more engine, so it has to cool more. And it also has a new exhaust. And yeah.
And it's got to exhaust more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this thing is new. That's kind of the point we're getting across. When you went from 790, 890, there was some carryover. Now, no. It's not happening.
And that explains why the 790 is back. It's because it's a completely different motorcycle.
Yeah, and if you think about the ladder, we were touching on it earlier. So you have the ladder from the 200 to the 390 to the 790 to the 990. Making that jump from, say, 390 to 990 might be a little ambitious, we'll say. And so having that 790 there as a middleway point between those two bikes makes a lot of sense. You know, that said, before we get into the other stuff, with the engine here, you get just really solid low-end torque delivery, makes it nice around town, very pleasant. But then that mid-range, that wealth of mid-range that you have, and an also over-end on the top end, it's an extremely exciting engine that drags probably the more serious traits out of the 890. Amplifies them here, obviously, because it's just got more CCs to do it with. And then you're getting something that, well, it just feels a bit more refined. And that even extends to the shifting and the updated quick shifter itself, the up-down quick shifter. So everything that we're experiencing with this engine is better. And obviously, that's something that we always hope when you're going to an updated platform. It would really suck to see a brand regress, you know? But like I said, this engine is really, really questioning a lot of things about both the middleweight class and the leader bike class because it's hitting that sweet spot. And that's going to be a reoccurring theme in this conversation as we start kind of talking about the chassis and things like that as well. But it's kind of the engine in a nutshell. I dug it.
You mentioned that like the sweet spot was 3,000 to 7,000 RPM. You know, it's a big twin. So is there not a lot of over rev?
No, it'll carry through. it'll carry through. So the sweet spot, you know, that happy zone that you're probably always going to be riding in is from 3 to 7. And that doesn't mean you have to short shift it once you get up to 7 grand. You can rip all the way to the red line if you want to. But where that, you know, you're riding on the roads, you're riding on the canyons, you have this massive kind of playful area between there before stuff gets really heavy duty up in the top end, but it still doesn't fall on its face when it goes in the top end. There is some taper way at the top, which is pretty predictable for a parallel twin power plant. But, you know, the fact that we are centering on that sweet spot between 3 and 7, that's kind of where you're just going to naturally live with this thing, because it's got just such good power delivery right then and there. And it's just always going to have good snap at, from the throttle.
Okay. Does it have any of the, you know, any fancy firing order or anything?
So it has a 285 degree crank, a little different than, you know, what we see in a lot of parallel twins, which is 270. That's become quite popular these days. That said, still got a really good exhaust note and also good character. Again, some of that personality is carrying over from the 790 to the 890 to this. It's just more refined. You know, when we first met the 790, it kind of shook up the middleweight class in a lot of ways. That was a super exciting bike for the time period. And then only a few years later, we got the 890, which was even better. Now we're at the 990. And although the conversation is naturally changing, because like you said, we are knocking on the door of 1,000 cc's. I think a lot of that playfulness is still here. It's just delivered with a lot more seriousness.
Well, I feel like, you know, listen, you know, thinking about this, and we need to come up with new terms, because middleweight, you know, that weight kind of has to do with pounds rather than, you know, and it's kind of not about that. It seems like it's about like peak horsepower. And when you talk about a traditional liter bike, we're now talking about 200 horsepower.
Yeah. And so it is middleweight in that perspective. You know, if you're looking at peak horsepower, yeah, it's smack in the middle pretty much.
Yeah, it's only 120 compared to 200.
Yeah, the 1390 makes like 190, is it 192 or 196? For all intents and purposes, it's 200. You have a Street Fighter V4, they're knocking on the door 200, M1000 or, you know, whatever.
And this is 120. So this is considerably, you know, considerably down from that. But I assume that it's all about the torque, which is what riding on the street is really all about.
Yeah, not only is it all about the torque for a lot of the naked bikes, but it's the rideability. And it's low speed manners. It's mid speed manners. And what I mean by mid speed is, you know, you might be cruising around town, you know, jumping on the freeway, doing stuff like that, but not doing anything particularly engaging. And, you know, the throttle response is very good. Of course, you have, you know, the different ride modes where you can tailor things. But before you get into all that stuff, just the engine's behavior, it does a lot with that bump in displacement, to where it's really smoothed out a lot of the, you know, just the roughness that we may have seen going back to the 790, which is why they added weight to the crank to kind of smooth it out into the 890. And the, you know, that's playing out here again. So yeah, it is a middleweight. If you look at it from a different perspective, if you only use performance as a barometer and in displacement, yeah, the conversation gets a little screwy, but yeah, overall the engine is quite versatile. And I think that's what we're hinting at, is this thing is as badass as it wants to be, but it can also kind of straighten the tie up and, you know, not use 4-letter words every other word in a sentence, although it wants to desperately.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking we could like steal from MotoGP. You have like the premier class, which would be the Panigale V4, you know, even like a Yamaha MT10, you know, those kind of bikes. And then you have the intermediate class, which would be these like 100-ish horsepower bikes. And then you have the junior class, whatever they would call, you know, the smaller class, you know, the equivalent of Moto 3, which is the, you know, small twins and singles, you know, say generally in the sub 500 range.
Yeah. If that's how you want to look at it. Of course, you know, It's tough because middleweight is just so broad at this point.
Yeah, that's why because it talks about poundage. It always seems like a little odd to talk about, because I assume that this 990 isn't a lot different in weight than a what we would call a leader bike, right?
Yeah, it is significantly lighter.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's 418 pounds, so it is a bit heavier than the 890 because, you know, just to be direct about it, it is slightly larger in terms of its physical size, but it didn't gain a whole heck of a lot when you compare it to an 890, which I think, if I remember right, was only about 410 or something like that. Maybe a little lighter. I can't entirely remember, but you start comparing, you know, this bike's weight to Aprilia Tuono Factor or V4 Factories, Street Fighter V4s, et cetera, et cetera. And you're looking at bikes that are in the mid 450s, and you know that kind of weight, and they're also physically much larger than this.
So the middleweight still has legs, because these bikes haven't gotten overweight. Because it's it'd be easy for these bikes to start getting porky as they, you know, keep adding on weight. You have heavier
features and
yeah. Okay, so there's still legs in middleweight. And again, most people, 120 horsepower is going to be plenty on the street.
Yeah, for me, like I mentioned before, I think 120 horsepower really hits that sweet spot for the type of riding that I personally enjoy doing. I think on the road, when you're talking about 100, I don't know, honestly, 100, 150, 160, 170, 200 horsepower, it's all kind of lost in the blur that is whatever you're doing while ripping through a canyon. 120 really satiates in pretty much any environment that you can put it in, whether it's a racetrack or a canyon road or just going to work. And it's not going to overwhelm, you know, an experienced rider or, you know, someone that's coming up, jumping up from a lightweight bike. It's not going to be as intimidating. And that's a really key factor that we should note here as well, where a lot of these bikes are just not going to have that same intimidation factor that the 1390 would, for example.
Well, now as part of that, you know, adjustable through electronics, though. I mean, you could make if you took the 1390 and put it in the rain mode, it's probably not too intimidating, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know that some of them, it's funny, every company institutes these rain modes and things in different ways. Some cut horsepower, others I've found they keep the same, like if you rev it up, it'll say like, oh, well, you don't really care about the rain, and it'll give you full power at the high end of the rev range. But at the low end of the rev range, the throttle response is very slow.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, rain modes are always going to curb either peak horsepower or they're really going to tame the throttle response. But speaking in particular to stuff like the 1390, Street Fighter V4, Aprilia Tuono V4 Factory, BMW M1000R, MT10, things like that, even in a rain mode, you're still talking about a bike that has a lot of performance under the saddle. And yeah, it's just kind of a different beast. They're a lot more cutthroat and they're a lot more serious and they're not to be trifled with in most cases, even in a rain mode, you know, whether they're cutting horsepower or not.
Okay. Okay. So the 990 buyer, he comes in and he still has modes to work with. Now, aren't there some optional modes too that he can do, or, you know, how would he make that transition and then where would he go with it as he becomes more comfortable with the bike?
Yeah. So this isn't going to shock anyone that's pretty familiar with KTM strategies. They typically offer two extra modes.
So they have three standard modes.
Yeah, there are three standard modes. Let's just talk about kind of the electronics as a whole. Now, they instituted the demo mode, which is a 1500 mile mode that gives you access to everything and then switches off after 1500 miles, and then you have to go and install it. It was controversial, whatever. I don't entirely care right now, so we're going to go ahead and talk about other stuff.
Yeah, we could have a whole podcast arguing about that.
Yeah, everything that is labeled as an option or can be disabled in demo mode lives under what is known as the tech pack. And essentially that covers your adjustable riding modes, your on the fly adjustable traction control, there's 9 levels, your two ABS modes, one cornering ABS mode, which is a standard front rear ABS mode. And then you have a front only Supermoto ABS mode, which is more performance oriented. You have the KTM engine braking system known as MSR, so motor slip regulation. And then also living under the tech pack umbrella, you have cruise control, launch control, and the up down quick shifter. So when you buy the 990, if you are a customer of more, we'll say, sporting persuasion that wants the ability to dive into your settings and adjust things, you're going to have to pay for this tech pack $935 right out of the gate. Is it annoying because some of the other competitors offer this stuff just part of the program? Yeah, but KTM packages everything together. You pay your money, they activate everything, good to go, done deal. Okay, that said, let's actually talk about the functions. We hit on the fact that it has, you know, adjustable TC, ABS, engine braking modes, and also throttle maps. So you have 3 preset riding modes of sport, street, and rain. You can't adjust anything with that, but remember those modes because they apply to the throttle maps. So as you adjust your throttle maps in the performance and track riding modes, which are adjustable, you can make any configuration of those prior mentioned throttle maps. And then there's also a track throttle map as well, which is the most aggressive. Now, I use the sport and street riding maps pretty much all day because we only rode on the street. And yeah, street is, it's livable. It's a real world map and keeps things pretty tame. You also have a sport map that definitely wicks it up a notch. And yeah, if you want to get rowdy, that's the one to use. Track is, well, I would say it's probably good for the racetrack, but in my personal opinion, I would put it in the track mode and then actually back off the throttle map and then adjust my rider aids as I want to. The big thing with the rider aids that we've been kind of hammering on for the last minute or so comes, you can change all this stuff through the new five inch full color TFT display. And they've changed the menu system to make it a little bit more, we'll say, direct. It's actually kind of fun when you're going through the settings. So when you're adjusting wheelie control, it has a little graphic of a 990 Duke. So when you're at very low, it shows it just barely hovering the wheel. And then as you start moving it up and de-restricting wheelie control, the bike keeps wheeling higher and higher and higher, kind of comically high.
Does it have a 12 o'clock mode?
Yeah, it's like almost. And if you do it fast enough, it's like a flip book. So you can sit there and wheelie your 990 Duke from the dash, basically. But the TC works under the same premise. And the reason they went with this more so pictogram sort of interface is so riders could adjust things much easier on the fly. They could just look at kind of an illustration and be like, okay, cool, boom, boom, boom. And actually, that logic plays out. And the electronics package is super competitive. It's an IMU supported electronics package. Obviously, we didn't get to test the true limits of traction control on the street because you never do, or you never want to anyway. Although we did get into some elevation in the Andalusian mountains and found some snow. So I was really stoked to have traction control there.
So you'd ride through the snow.
Yeah. It was just cold enough to where there's snow collected on the side of the road and stuff like that. But yeah, the temperature was quite chilly during a small portion of that ride. So yeah, you crank up the nannies and the bike won't do anything, you know, untoward at all. And then once you start backing stuff off, yeah, thing gets rowdy just as a KTM should when you're down in the lower lands and there's more grip and more heat. There's like a 20 some odd degree difference between the where we were in elevation down to almost sea level, basically. It was pretty crazy, actually. But at any rate, yeah, quick shifter works better, shifting works better. You know, better than what we've experienced with prior iterations of KTMs, because sometimes they can be a little bit notchy. But yeah, this one's working pretty good. And the electronics package is quite competitive. Yeah. So RideWire, it's all they're dialing it in pretty sweet now.
Yeah, all the latest goodies and all easy to use, which is really what you want when you're riding. So it's in a chassis. Where are we going with the chassis?
Yeah, so didn't mention this in the story, but I wanted to. All new chassis, still a steel tubular chassis that uses the engine as a stress member, swing arm, directly mounts to the engine, saving weight, et cetera, et cetera. Like we mentioned before, the bike's 418 pounds. So not the lightest, but certainly one of the lighter examples in the class. And without looking at the spec sheet, you'd probably assume it's one of the lightest ones because it is quite agile. But they've gone ahead and really sought out additional stiffness. And to that end, the frame boasts 15% additional lateral and torsional rigidity overall. And they credit that sort of stiffness due to its design, where it actually captures the swing arm between the frame lowers, or the frame spars, as some might call them. So the frame itself bolts to the outside of the swing arm, pinching it between, the swing arm. Before, the opposite was true on the 890. It's actually the same strategy that we saw with the 2020 or 2021 Yamaha MT-09 when it got the last big update. But that's the exact same thing that Yamaha did. I don't think KTM was staring at Yamaha and went, oh man, we gotta do that. Because look, manufacturers go back and forth with this stuff all the time. So whatever. But chassis design is always about balance. And to compensate for that extra stiffness, they actually reduced the rigidity of the swing arm by a very significant 35%. It's now a closed lattice construction, so it just looks like a cast swing arm. Essentially, the other swing arm on the 890 and 790 were that steel trellis frame kind of lattice construction, and this looks a lot more conventional. That said, even though it has more flex, it's actually 3.3 pounds lighter. KTM says that this has achieved a better balance that really seeks to foster better mechanical grip out of the rear and the front simultaneously, so you get more feedback, which in my experience on super curvy, super technical, in just endlessly windy roads in Spain, that holds up pretty well, because this thing gives monstrous amounts of feedback. It really retains, the chassis retains that tried and true 890 agility. Some could argue maybe it's not just as quick-footed as the 890, just quite, but the stability is bumped up significantly. So that's a trade-off that I'm willing to make all day long.
Right. I mean, part of that would be just the motor, the heavier crank, more going around, it's going to cause a bike to be, less agile.
Yeah. I mean, first, the bike is heavier. Two, like you said, you have more physics in play. You got a heavier crank. And you got more piston, you got more stuff spinning around. The wheels are actually derived from the 1290/1390 Super Duke R. The rear one, although it's the only critical difference is that it's made for a conventional swing arm instead of a single-sided swing arm, but the wheels are pretty much ripped from that bike. And kind of on that gyroscopic forces note, the brakes are a carryover from the 790 and the base model 890 Duke. They've actually lightened the carriers in the front by over 2 pounds, which is pretty crazy when you think about it, because it's like, damn, it's just a brake carrier. Like, there was that much weight to lose. And that reduces a lot of unsprung mass. So, yeah, citing the physics of it, that could easily explain the sort of difference between an 890 and a 990. But the stability is just, it makes the bike feel more mature and honestly more serious. The 790, the 890 always had this really playful kind of, it was a bit supercharged in its playfulness. But it was always kind of a street bike. And you're like, yeah, this is fun. This thing's having fun, whatever. 990 is a little more serious. Kind of wants to make those punches land, if you know what I mean.
which is makes the argument for the 790 and the 990 both existing, because they would appeal to different, you know, sensibilities.
Yeah, you know, I think they're definitely they're flavors of each other, but this is a more serious machine, not necessarily for a more serious rider either, because like I said, the engine can be incredibly forgiving if you just want to cruise around. You don't have to do dank nooners and put this thing at 12 o'clock, although KTM marketing would really encourage you to do so.
Did KTM break out the high-end WP suspension for this?
So we're running WP Apex semi-adjustable suspension. We have 5 clicks of rebound and compression on the fork, and then we have rebound and spring preload on the shock. The baseline setup is probably a little stiffer than the 890, definitely a lot stiffer than the 790. That didn't really have any meaningful adjustment. And honestly, the performance between those bikes is a significant step away from each other. But it's not going to rattle your teeth out. You could easily crank things to the right because any sort of adjustment makes it a noticeable step. Okay, you know, you have 5 clicks and you go, oh, well, that's not a whole lot. My Ohlins has 30 some odd positions. True. KTM's logic on this one was to just kind of simplify it. And like, look, it's a street bike that can rip. Like, we just want to make it as direct and easy and user-friendly as possible. So these steps are going to be, I don't want to use the word dramatic, but they make a perceptible difference. You don't have to like be a suspension guru to figure that out on your own. So they're kind of simplifying things for consumers, which is pretty cool. But in terms of the actual suspension, yeah, the WP Apex stuff works great.
They don't have semi-axis suspension. I assume they don't have electronically adjustable suspension. Do you have to break out tools to start twiddling little, you know, screws, or how do you adjust the damping?
On the shock, you would have to dive into the toolkit under the seat. On the fork, this is something that KTM does on a lot of models, even in the off-road segment. They just have those toolless clickers that you can just spin, you know, the little plastic kind of...
Look like little pinwheels.
Yeah, like fly nuts, basically.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't think I should really encourage this, but riding around, I'm like, yeah, I think the fork could use a little more, and then I'll try it out, or I'll be like, I didn't like that, kind of go back. And yeah, I mean, it's simple enough to where I can do it while riding. So yeah.
Okay. Well, it's not as convenient as electronically adjustable, but more convenient than having to use tools, and at least on the fork.
Yeah. Semi-active.
Well, not even just semi-active. I'm just talking about, you know, there are examples of electronically adjustable suspension that you control, but you control it. It's not semi-active.
Yeah. That, you know, electronically adjustable suspension and or semi-active suspension, it's more of a rarity in this kind of subcategory. As we get into leader bikes, that's where it really is kind of, I don't want to say it's becoming ubiquitous, but it's becoming
ubiquitous. It is. That's becoming the feature that you expect.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like, look, man, we're paying top dollar. Just give us all the things.
Right. These are the flagship bikes. You expect all the flagship features to be there. So this bike, being a middleweight, doesn't have quite that high end of a use.
No. But the suspension's good. It's again, like I said, it's set up at a baseline a little bit sportier, which really matches the bike's chassis, the stiffness that they're going for, and helps things keep composed. But even through broken asphalt, because you're going to find, you know, a lot of that in Spain, just as much as you would in California, and it's not going to beat you up, you know. So it has good hold up. The thing really hooks up out of corners. It doesn't squat excessively. It's not doing anything like that. It doesn't feel wallowy anywhere. And that's something that's really important, because if you go back to the 790, I mean, back then they were using progressive spring rates in the front, and, you know, the bike was a lot smaller, a lot less powerful, so you could kind of get away with that sort of stuff. But it really made us beg for that 790 Duke R, despite the fact that when that 790 came out, holy man, I mean, there were some editors within the motorcycle kind of magazine game that purchased them on their own, because we all loved it that much. So if that's not a testament, well, I don't know what is, because honestly, that's probably not a great testament, because like no one cares about our opinion anyway. But you know,
yes, they care about our descriptions, because we, you know, that's kind of what it's about. Everybody's going to buy the bike.
Not our personal opinions, but
they're going to buy the bike that's right for them, and that's kind of what we're here to help people do. Okay, you talked about the lighter brake carriers. How are the brakes?
Brakes are one of the few carryover parts from the base model 790 and 890. You guys will recognize them. They're the KTM branded four piston J1 calipers that hook up to a matching J1 master cylinder, axial master cylinder via steel braided brake lines. Steel braided brake lines are a nice touch. I think if you were to upgrade anything, it'd be that master cylinder. Kind of the same stuff that we said about the 790 and ostensibly the base model 890 Duke R, or sorry, the 890 Duke, not the R model that has fancy Brembo stuff. You know, there's a little bit of initial sweep in that lever that you kind of don't expect, and then a very soft bite. And when you're talking about a bike of this kind of performance caliber, I would want a little bit something more. Now, there is plenty of braking power. It's not an issue of like, oh my God. It's just, I just want more bite sort of deal. So while you could throw some pads at it, realistically, I think just ponying up a couple hundred bucks and getting a master cylinder, if you're that hardcore guy or gal, would be a good route. But that also, like we mentioned before earlier in the podcast, is this an R model? No. This is one of those bits, like the suspension and its adjustability amount and its features, where a 990 Duke R would take that to fully adjustable suspension. And then we'd have stuff like a Brembo, MCS master cylinder, you know, with span and ratio adjustable, and Brembo Stylema calipers and stuff like that. But yeah, this is what we got, and it worked fine.
Yeah, it's worth noting for people who are unfamiliar with J1 brakes, they're owned by Brembo.
Yeah, now, yeah.
So it's kind of, I always kind of think of them as kind of a European version of the Bybri brakes.
Yeah, they're an interesting company. So they're Spanish by way of China. And people might recognize them from their association with the factory Kawasaki teams in World Superbike. Johnny Ray always used to have a fat J1 stamp on his leathers, although we're probably not using the same stuff they were. But the brakes, they could be a little bit better in certain contexts, but power is there. And that's the stressor that I need to state. Anytime we make these claims of brakes, I don't want anyone going, they're not going to stop. Dude, don't even go there. That is, safety is not an issue. That's something that that was a bit of a trigger for me, but you know what I mean?
Right. Well, part of braking is the tires. How are the tires?
They use a tried and true tires. So they use the Bridgestone BattleX Hypersport S22 tire. Interestingly, Bridgestone has updated to the S23, but at the time of the KTM's development, the S23 wasn't going to be available. So they reached for the S22 because it was. The S23 was announced last year? And we just sampled it recently. So you can see that the 992 kind of fell between, generations tire. That said, if you're going to go and rip a track day and, ride aggressively on the street, the S22 is going to treat you right. We've used it multiple times on the track at different launches. In fact, the last, the 2020 KTM 1290 Super Duke R, we rode Portimao and used Bridgestone S22 tires all day. So they're not lacking. You can do a very serious track day on big bikes on them and you're A-okay. Would a slick give you more grip? Yeah, sure. Also, kind of obvious, but there you go.
So we've talked about the track, talked about the street. When somebody hops on the KTM 990 Duke, what ergonomics are they faced with?
So if you're familiar with the 790, the 890, you're not going to be in for a huge surprise. It's a sporty but pretty reasonable seating position. I think the seat height is at 32.5 inches. So it's pretty amenable. If you're a shorter rider, middleweights and lightweight bikes are much more conducive than a lot of the heavyweight motorcycles or leader class bikes, just because they're physically smaller. And that still is relevant here. You know, the 990 Duke does look a bit more muscular because the fuel tank has increased just a hair. It's gone up to, I think, 3.8 gallons. But really, the bodywork is a little bit bulkier. And so it just has that more muscular look. And how that translates when you're actually sat behind the bars is that you have a bit more to grip on the fuel tank, right? And then supporting that narrative is a redesigned seat. It's actually 2 degrees lifted upward in the front to prevent you from sliding forward, which is something that you could experience on the 890. It felt really slim because of that parallel twin packaging. And it also had a very slim fuel tank, which is something that KTM has always leaned into. This is just a bit girthier between the knees, and it gives you a little bit more to brace when you're hard braking, which is super helpful. So it actually reduces fatigue in comparison to, you know, hell, if you're riding a 790, at a faster clip, I think this would just be a little bit easier to ride in certain capacities in terms of comfort. And then when we're talking about the handlebar, it's a multi-position handlebar. I believe it's 4 positions overall. You can scoot it forward and back. And yeah, it feels appropriately middleweighty. You know, it's not too wide. It really gives you the sense that, look, yeah, this is a big middleweight, but it's not a leader class bike. It's physically not as big. Okay. And it still has that middleweight sensibility to it when you're hucking the thing around, because it is easy to manipulate and maneuver. And sat in the saddle, you're like, okay, this thing is comfy. I can ride all day on this thing. Yeah, it's naked. Yeah, you're going to take it to the chest, but that's kind of how naked bikes are. So fine. I don't think anyone's going to tour on this thing. You know,
that's what they have the 890 SMT for.
Yeah. I mean, even then it's like, but well, Super Duke GT.
Right. But then you're net back into the 200 horsepower world or 175 or whatever.
Yeah. So this is one of those things where you're like, okay, yeah, it's more than livable. There's great leg room, good ground clearance. Okay. Yeah, it just kind of works.
Who's going to buy this bike?
I think anyone that's more performance oriented. So you want a do-it-all. You just want a do-it-all, gnarly, fun, naked bike. And honestly, since the parallel twin naked motorcycles from KTM have come out, that's kind of the section of this middleweight segment that's been owned by KTM. You can say that some of the other bikes offer better fit and finish. They do this better, that better, whatever. Cool. But when it comes to actually going and ripping a track day, having fun in the canyons, wheelies, stoppies, slides, whatever, no one's going to hold a candle to KTM. Sorry, just the way it is. Well, with the 990, this thing has matured quite a bit. So the engine feels more mature. The fit and finish is actually more mature. Now we have all around LED lighting, and actually the aesthetic design from Kiska, which is the design house that KTM partners with, coincides with the rest of the Duke lineup. And it's a trickle down from the 1390. So while we rarely talk about aesthetics in a, well, we like this because it's all in a eye of the beholder thing, there is no doubt in my mind that this is one very upset looking motorcycle, which really leans into just what this bike is about. It just wants to fight everything.
It's belligerent.
Yeah, not to a drunken point. It's more of a...
Well, you can be belligerent without drinking.
Yeah, you could be. It's kind of like when you see an MMA fighter have to get a normal job. You know, he can keep it down. You know, he's not going to fight every customer. But if he could,
Or like if he works at McDonald's.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the thing about the Dukes is they've always been amazing when it comes to sport riding. And now this thing can be a little bit more civilized because, again, the engine has some more displacement to sort of fluff the numbers and make it a bit smoother. It's a little bit bigger. There's more stuff to brace against, so it's a little bit more comfortable in certain respects. The fueling's better. You have an updated electronics package. You know, at its price point, at a base price of $12,500, it's not anywhere near the prices that leader class naked bikes are demanding. So I think if you just want to do it all bike, this thing makes a better argument than a lot of stuff on the market. And that's kind of the thing. And that's why I think this bike is really changing the conversation, because even when, if you were to stack the 990 against, you know, some of the Japanese leader class bikes, like say the GSX S1000 or, you know, the MT10, this thing is going to make a pretty compelling argument. When you start getting into Aprilia Tuonos and Street Fighter V4s and 1390 Super Ducars and, you know, stuff like that, that's sort of a different, the Super Nakeds are a different conversation, but.
Right. I often like part of my, when I, in my head, kind of categorizing bikes is I also categorize them by price.
Yeah.
You know, you can't compare a $12,500 bike to a $23,500 bike, even if they're the same class. You know, they have like 50 cc difference. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, they're in different leagues, but
yeah, when people go into a dealership, they have like a budget in mind usually, you know, and so they're going to buy a bike that fits their ability to purchase.
Oh, for sure. And on that note, I actually think this would make an interesting story and comparison story, just because I think the 990 Duke in particular could go up against some of those bikes and you'd be like, you know what, this performance that we have, 120 horsepower, odd horsepower, whatever, kind of makes a little bit more sense. And this is coming from someone that absolutely loves stupid amounts of horsepower. So yeah, that's kind of how much I'm on board with this idea here.
I'm always persuaded by that because I'm not a big horsepower guy. It's like how I can ride a slower bike fast than I can a faster bike slow. And so,
well, then that's not just you. That's literally everyone, whether they want to admit it or not.
Right. But I admit it. I'm very, very, very clear that, you know, a Street Fighter V4 is not a good motorcycle for me on the street. You know, I just it overrides the street. So I want a bike that I can like be aggressive and, but not feel like, you know, I'm ringing the throttle and I want more. You know, I want to ring that throttle. You want that magic spot where you're ringing the throttle and that's pretty much all you want. Maybe there's a little tiny bit more. So, you know, for you to grow into as you become more comfortable, but that's what I'm always looking for in a bike.
Yeah. And that's for something like this, you know, the 765s, the MT09s, the 990 Dukes, they really latch onto that part of the conversation and they go, look, you don't need anything. This is it. And you kind of look at it and you go,
maybe that's true.
Yeah. So yeah. Are there any negatives about the bike? We touched on the brakes. There's one little kind of subjective thing about the motor slip regulation, which is that variable engine braking feature. If you're like trail braking super aggressively and just riding like, you know, Mr. Badass in the canyons, you want really consistent engine braking, especially when you're at the apex. So I would say disable that feature if you're that type of guy. Interestingly, when you put it in supermoto mode, which is the mode you'd use on a racetrack, that feature gets disabled as a default. And on the 1390 Super Duke, when you go into track mode, the same feature gets disabled. Because again, you're at the track and it's like you want dead set engine braking as you're powering down, you know, decelerating.
You want to get exactly what you expect.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the only two little hiccups. And it's tough to categorize the one MSR thing as a hiccup because
you can disable it, right?
Yeah. If you couldn't, then I'd be like, ugh. But
right.
No, and the brakes, yeah, it's not an issue. So
everybody listening should know that Nick is very particular about brakes. And you know, I'm kind of like, I want it to be a really soft entry level, you know, engagement And then if I need to brake hard, I want to be able to brake hard. But I, when I'm just riding around all the time, because I ride, you know, in the city sometimes, I don't want any sort of aggressive braking where the thing goes clunk. You know, I want it to always be soft engagement, and then, you know, very progressive, where you, the more you pull, the more like, oh yeah, and then finally it's like nose wheelie time. You know,
the main thing I wanted to get at with, you know, commenting about brakes or suspension or whatever, is when we review bikes, you know, the main thing that listeners and readers gotta know is you can't fix a bad engine. Okay. So you can fix a chassis that's a little wonky. You can fix ergonomics, because really ergonomics are particular to every individual, and you can fix, you know, whatever, but you can't truly fix a bad chassis. You know what I mean? You can't fix a bad engine. And the 990 Duke has engine and chassis to spare. It has comfort. It has this, it has that. So if our only little complaint is a master cylinder, screw it, dude. If you're that performance guy, you're that cutthroat, you know, kind of no holds barred dude, yeah, buy master cylinder. But do you need to? No, just like use this one. It's fine. I'm just kind of looking at it from that performance mindset. So yeah, this bike has a lot to talk about. And I think as we kind of get into those comparisons and things like that, I think KTM kind of struck some gold on this one, and we still got the 1390 to talk about too. So we'll do that another day, but we kind of put this one to rest here. So at $12,500 at the base as tested, it was $13,435 with the tech pack and all the goodies. Yeah. Yeah. There's a rad bike. It's kind of, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah. I can definitely tell that you liked it a lot. That's cool. I look forward to riding it. I look forward to, you know, we've been under the gun of new bikes this year, well in, you know, into April, which is unusual for us. And now we can kind of start doing some interesting comparison tests and getting out back out into the world instead of spending all our time at airports moving about. So, and I say that as, you know, I'm about to hop on a plane for the second time in 2 weeks, you know, to go to Europe, and you're going somewhere in California, I believe, for the Yamaha MT-09, which is kind of an interesting parallel bike to what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, and it just got a pretty significant update. So, you know, this middleweight class, it continues to be competitive, and, you know, there's a lot of manufacturers are throwing some firepower into it, and yeah, the KTM is just kind of another example of that. So there we go.
Cool. All right. Well, that's about all anybody needs to know about the 2024 KTM 990 Duke. And yep. On to the next bike. We'll talk to you later.
Cool. Sounds good.
In the second segment this week, I have a really enjoyable chat with Richard Warsham. He's the co-founder and designer of the exquisite retro-styled Janus motorcycles. Although manufactured in Goshen, Indiana with modern materials and using modern engines, the Janus range of bikes clearly harken back to a much simpler time. Richard admits that they can hardly be considered performance machines. So what exactly is it that makes these machines so darned attractive? Is it just the cool looks, or is there something else that's maybe not quite so obvious? Here's a quick reminder to leave us your comments on our social media. We're on all the usual platforms at Ultimate Motorcycling. We love hearing your feedback, so, good or bad, please let us know what you think. If there's something in particular you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear those ideas too. So we're going to be talking about, is it Janus motorcycles? Is that how you pronounce it?
That's right, yeah, Janus, not the English Janus motorcycles.
Janus, but... right, yes. Yeah, Janus motorcycles. Presumably, Janus, I think, was one of the gods, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a uniquely a Roman god. He didn't have a Greek predecessor, but he has two faces looking both directions, yeah.
Right, okay. Was that any influence on the name, or was that purely coincidence?
I spent a lot of time in school studying in Rome, and so I have I love Rome and Roman history, and to be honest, really, like, the there were a lot of the really cool names that you think about when you try to name a motorcycle brand, they've already been used by brand, you know, companies that are no longer in business. So if you want to be original, you have to look pretty hard. And that one appealed to me because of the historic kind of mythical connections, and also the idea of looking to the past and the future, kind of like what we do. So it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. So you were the guy that actually started the company, or did you start it with friends or investors?
So I started it with one other guy named Devin, Devin Beek, and I started Janus in 2011. It was sort of the getting started off of our background was vintage two-stroke mopeds. So
nice.
Little pedal type two strokes. And what started for me is really just a kind of fun, like goofy pastime, learning how to wrench on this two stroke, turned into making friends with people, riding together, wrenching on the bikes together, because you were always doing that on those things. And then meeting this guy who he had recently opened a shop that did repair work on him. And he kind of made a name for himself in the US, at least. There's this organization called the Moped Army. And it was made up of folks around, most of them were around my age 10 years ago. I mean, they were same age as me 10 years ago. And they had clubs or gangs, we called them, all over the country, San Francisco, New York, Portland. And some of them are still active, but there were thousands of people that were wanting performance parts for these vintage bikes. So he made a business out of selling parts for them. And through that process, he kind of roped me into working with him over the summers. And that was a lot of fun. And then through that, we were doing custom mopeds, basically. Like you think about the custom motorcycle scene, we were doing it with these, these mopeds. And through that, we realized that, well, you know all about it. Moride is a classic example of Elkhart County manufacturing. And there's not just Moride. There's literally thousands of other businesses that are serving that industry and other manufacturing industries in the area. And so we realized that once you start digging in, there's somebody that does just about everything you could possibly want. I think the only thing that they don't make around here are rims for motorcycles. Like,
of all,
you know, or motorcycle engines. You know, we don't have motorcycle engines, but we've got, you know, the ability to do just about everything else. So yeah, we started it 2011, came out with the first prototype in 2012. It was a 50cc two-stroke, so going right off this moped roots. And then we did that for a couple of years, just the two of us, until we realized that if we wanted to really make it a thing, we had to get EPA certification and be able to sell around the country. And so we raised money to do that and launched the 250 line, which is still our bread and butter. I mean, that Halcyon 250 is the bike that we sell the most of to this day.
So how did you kind of got started with the 250s, and then you thought, you know, we're going to have to offer something a little bigger.
Yeah.
And that was a natural development. Is that how you got into that?
Yeah. So the 250 was really a move out of the need to get emissions certification. And in our estimation, going like our philosophy with bikes, even back then, we didn't have a way of really talking about it as much as we do now, was to find an engine that took advantage of the same things that we appreciated about mopeds. So low power, low displacement, really easy to work on, and a lot of parts availability, and something that the owner could be involved in, as opposed to like a modern fuel injected ECU controlled, you know, something that you really wouldn't be able to understand as well. So the smallest engine that would kind of fit that bill that we could find was a 250. I think we probably would have gone with a 125 if we had found one that, you know, fit our bill, or if we could have found a two stroke, we would have gone with that. I still love my two strokes, but no way that was getting through EPA. So we that's when we chose the 250. And that has served us really well. The kind of riding that these bikes are, you know, you can imagine the kind of riding that these are suited for. They're not designed for track days or highway slab or, you know, getting a super like, I'll go ahead and say a practical way of like commuting. You can do it. And plenty of our owners do commute on their Janus, but these are bikes that are more designed for leisure activity, beautiful scenic roads, taking your time and enjoying yourself, which my argument, my claim is that that's what motorcycles are for. I mean, you can ride around the world. You can commute every day of the year on them in Wisconsin if you want to. But the reason that most of us ride a bike most of the time is to experience this sort of agency over what we're doing and just be out in the wind and enjoy ourselves. So that's what we kind of centered the bikes around. But as we kept making them, we had owners that said, well, we listened to our owners and people were saying, well, you know, I live in LA and I need to be able to get to the twisty roads. I need to hop on the interstate and be able or I want to be able to ride a little faster or whatever, you know, what have you. I'm a bigger guy, whatever. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'6" and I still ride a 250, but,
wow.
Okay. but the 450 really kind of sprung out of that, the need for a bike that had a little more power, a little more oomph, and would be able to go over 70 miles an hour, which is the top speed on the 250. So our goal was 80 miles an hour, 30 horsepower, and a rear suspension. Because that, I should mention that the 250 Halcyon, our top model, is a hardtail. So when we say classic, it really does channel a pre-war almost era motorcycle in terms of function and ride and stuff like that. Now, most of those bikes, pre-war bikes, were not super heavy. They were not super powerful. And so people forget that when they try and hardtail your Harley nowadays, you're getting hit in the back with 700 plus pounds of, you know, steel. You're not necessarily on a lightweight bike like that. So our 250s are actually, they're great bikes. They're very comfortable to ride around on. But we knew when we were going faster with a heavier bike, more power, rear suspension. So we did add rear suspension. That was a big move for us on the, we had softail bikes in our model lineup, but for the Halcyon. And so we worked really hard to preserve those lines of the Halcyon that the hardtail allows. So it sort of uses a softtail design similar to like a bobber or a Harley softtail, where it looks like it's a hardtail, but it has a suspension underneath it. And we didn't go to a new designs. We went back to kind of a Phil Vincent design, 1928 cantilever with the paired shocks under the seat, which is fun. It looks really neat, and it achieved the aims that we wanted of concealing it. And so, yeah, we launched that about 3 years ago, and then we've done a couple of different product releases since then. But that's been the last model we've come out with. And then this last week, a week and a half ago, it was last week we launched our Griffin 450, which is our Scrambler 450. So same platform as the Halcyon 450, but in a Scrambler configuration. So again, kind of channeling not a modern dirt bike, not necessarily a dual sport, but a capable bike that's good for off-road and on-road in line with traditional Scramblers. So yeah, that's kind of, we've just kind of covered the whole trajectory in a quick swing there of what we've been up to.
So you're clearly building these around just a couple of engines, you know, the 250 and the 450. Whereabouts, I mean, sort of starting with that, with the heart of the motorcycle, where do you source the engines from? I mean, are these, where are you getting those engines?
Yeah, so when we started with the 50, we went to Spain and the Derby. So the famous two-stroke manufacturer Derby has been known for decades now, half a century of both off-road and GP racing in two-stroke small displacement. And that was a great engine. It's hard to find small displacement motors these days. And so especially ones that have a lot of parts availability and are, you know, the kind of, that have the provenance, which is a funny word to use, because our 250 we sourced from China. And I use the word provenance, but in searching for a motor, we found this, it's basically the predecessor to the CB125. It's called the CG125, and it was developed originally by Honda in the early 70s. Their goal was, I think my understanding is that around that time, Honda was really, like, they're kind of famous for not interested in two strokes as much as their competitors. And so they found at that period, we're finding a lot of that was kind of handicapping them because of the ease of maintenance on a two stroke. They were just easier to keep running in, especially developing countries, Southeast Asia, Pakistan, all those kind of India, South America actually has a huge market for that kind of a motorcycle. And so they developed the CG, and the CG is basically a CB without the overhead cams or cam. And it just uses it's really simple. They basically just made it as stupid simple as they could. One cam that operates intake and exhaust valves with little push rods, really robust. It was designed, I mean, they actually sent their engineers out to watch what these people were doing with their bikes. And they realized there was no preventative maintenance. It broke. Now we'll fix it and then we'll break it again after a while. So oil changes weren't as big of a thing. So they developed this engine to kind of address that. And it's one of the most mass produced engines in the history of motorcycling. You'll still see them all over South America and Asia. And so probably in the 90s, Honda, first of all, Honda developed this engine to be manufactured in satellite facilities. So they've always been made in Pakistan, China, South America. And so they're readily available, and they have this, the design has been, you know, reworked and improved for literally half a century. And so, when we started looking at engines, we're like, oh, this might be a great starting point so long as we can pass EPA. And so that was a big gamble we took. Was we got several different versions because they're made by lots of different factories now. But what I was going to say is in the 90s, Honda, obviously engine technology was improving and the maintenance capacities of developing countries was improving. That was one of the problems that places like India had, is there were no dealerships and service locations. So as those improved and metallurgy improved, they weren't as interested in it. And so a lot of those engine rights expired, and other manufacturers started making them around the world. And so you can get a lot of different versions, and some of them are good quality as you might expect, and some of them are not. So we got a lot. Some of them are really not so. So we got a lot of different versions of the engine in, and just really by our experience with vintage bikes, working on old CBs or mopeds or two strokes, kind of like ran them, looked at the metallurgy, tried to figure out which one we thought was going to be the best one, and arrived at, we lucked out, a motor that is still one of my favorite engines. I would ride that thing around the world if I had the opportunity. And not worry about things breaking. So we do source it. It's mainland China. It's a smaller manufacturer. It's not one of the big like Lifan or Shinrei. It's a smaller manufacturer that builds them to our spec. We have our engine, our logo in the side. We've been importing those for, 7 years or more now. I think what really would speak to our confidence in that motor is the fact that the standard warranty on our bikes is a 4-year warranty. And that's unlimited mileage, 4 years, fender to fender, and it includes the engine and powertrain. So we don't have any issues with these motors. They're great. You're not going to win any races on them, but you're going to have a lot of fun and be able to do all the maintenance.
They're so low stressed.
Exactly.
Yeah, provided you do, and I would think it, as you said, it's probably not even that important, but provided you change the oil occasionally. And
yeah, if the valves are off, it'll tell you, you'll know.
So it sounds like they're carbureted and not fuel injected.
That's right. So the 250 line, I really was kind of thought, I don't know, I was very optimistic and lucked out, I guess, but we said, we're going to try and get this thing through EPA with a carburetor. We think we can do it. And we did some trial runs, of course, to prove of the concept. And we actually ended up the initial runs with this engine, we passed the emission standards without a catalyst in the exhaust. So just straight tailpipe emissions were would meet it. Now, what we ended up doing was we do have a catalyst, because one of the aspects of emissions testing is you have to first of all test it for thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometers on the rolling road, and then you basically project out the life of a engine, which EPA I think is like 10 years. They make you warranty emissions components for 10 years. And so we wanted to make sure that as the, you know, the engine wears in and breaks down, it would still maintain those standards. So, and it passed with flying colors. So yeah, it's a carbureted bike, manual choke on the carburetor. So it's very involved. You're engaged in the entire process because it doesn't really rev up really high. We don't have a tach on it. You just feel it. It has a little speedometer, not that big. All, you know, it has a needle and not a digital thing. So we're all about making this a very analog, visceral experience. And that's really what our owners enjoy about the bikes. And the fact that the aesthetics are, you roll up on one of these things and nobody's like, you know, what year is that? And you say, oh, it's a 23.
Are they like 1923?
Leave them to figure out what you mean. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Although interesting, it looks as though, correct me if I'm wrong, it looks as though you do run an oil cooler with them. And that's got to help with the longevity as well, I would think.
Yeah. So you're either looking at an aftermarket. We have, oddly enough, even with our small number of owners, we have a couple of thousand of these out there.
Well, I'm looking at the Halcyon, you know, on your website, and it looks like there's a sort of an oil cooler at the front. But
yeah, that would be our 450. And so the 450 is air and oil cooled. And when we moved to that one, we decided that we were going to go with fuel injection. So the 450 is a fuel injected motorcycle as well. And that's a combination of experience with, you know, some customers really enjoy carburation and warming a bike up. Some people don't so much, or they're less familiar with it. Our number one service issue we run into is, you know, warming the bike up, or people are out of fuel, or, you know, it's something like that. So we did decide to go with emission or a fuel injection, and it made it getting through EPA considerably easier than the first time around. And yeah, the SWM engine is, I won't, you know, go too long on the history of that one, but it's a neat engine as well. A really interesting Italian brand that I heard about through, what is the name of that company? Clues Competition Works, CCM. Clues Competition Motors is an English brand, and they use SWM motors in their bikes.
Yes, I've heard of SWM motors. Yeah,
yeah, they were a 1970s trials bike company based out of Milan, or north of Milan, and they went out of business in the 80s when a lot of companies did, and they were restarted in 2014 by basically the Harley Davidson, BMW sold Husqvarna and left a factory in right across the lake from MV Agusta, actually. Yeah, isn't that interesting? And they, Biondrono, Italy is where the factory is. And he basically took all the tooling from Husqvarna, because Husky basically is a rebranded KTM. I forget which.
Yes. They're owned by they're a mobility group. Yeah.
It's not their own engine anymore, though. So they took all that technology and turned it into a revamped version of SWM, and with a lot of Chinese funding. And that's where they started. Most of their bikes are dual sport or off-road bikes, but they also have a classic line of air-cooled, air and oil-cooled engines. And they based that air-cooled engine off of the Honda XR400, which is an enduro. It's basically the same story: bulletproof, lower power, very reliable, easy to work on engine. And that's the engine that we use on our 450. I got to go over and visit and see the factory and meet everybody and kind of learn a little bit about that before we started working with them.
So in terms of design, were you sort of the original designer of the motorcycles, or do you have a team of guys that are?
Well, we have about 20 people that work here at Janus. That's a very small team. Starting off, it was just, like I mentioned, the two of us, Devin and I, working on the bikes. But I've always done the design work up through about 4 years ago, a year before we launched the 450, we realized we needed help. I wasn't going to be able to do all the design of a motorcycle of that level of complexity in the time frame that we basically launched it in about 2 years. And we hired a young engineer straight out of school. And so they're from then until now, it's a team of two of us. I am not an engineer. I'm actually trained as an architect. So my design, my approach to it is highly aesthetically oriented. I'll say that. And I've picked up a lot on the side in terms of, and we have a wealth of people in the area that I can turn to when it comes to technical questions. But now that we have an engineer, he can really, it's been a great to have a team. And then a lot of the design stuff, we go to the whole team and say, hey, what do you think about this? We have a review and get everybody's input on it. But I do kind of, that's my main focus is design.
I mean, I can't decide if they're custom order or not. I mean, clearly you can custom order them, but you also seem to carry inventory as well.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't think we've been able to really answer what we are yet. It's this weird gap between custom and production. Now, I will say that all the way back to the first bikes we built, my interest and what gets me ticking is production. I love a custom bike. I love art, but what gets me interested in these is the idea of not what I can create with an angle grinder once, but what we can create after 15 or 1500, how much better it gets. And you can create something that would cost you $20,000 to do once for quite a bit less, and then sell it and try and make money off of it as well, or employ people to do it. We do have a lot of options. So it's a modular kind of system that, you know, has a frame and tanks and everything like that, but different tins, but we allow for a extraordinarily high degree of choice when it comes to the customer. And most of our sales that we have, someone will come to us and we will walk them through a very long menu of options, upgrades, choices that they have with their bike. And then it takes anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks, depending on how long our lead time is, to build their bike, and then it'll be shipped to them. So most of the time we're not seeing the same bike every day. It's they're highly differentiated, literally thousands of different permutations, because we offer, I think it starts at like 12 stock colors and then goes, I mean, I just was walking in the back and there's a custom color that I've never seen before. Somebody picked, and then when you add in hand pinstriping with two different colors and engraving, and it can kind of go from there. So yeah, where I get confused with what we're doing is when customers are like, hey, can I put a different logo on the tank? And I go, hold on. No, you know, we're a production company. There, it has to have certain rules.
Right. But that's fascinating though, because I've never done this, but there must be a lot of joy for an end owner to be able to personalize it so much, to really make it, put your own imprimatur on it, really make it feel like it's yours. You're not just walking to a showroom and just slapping down your credit card and buying something. I mean, you're actually, you know, thinking it through and what color you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case.
So part of the ordering process has got to be part of the joy of ownership, I should think.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a big part of the process, and it's one that we work very hard to enrich that experience. So we really encourage folks when they buy a bike to come visit us. And if they can't visit us when they're ordering it, to at least pick it up in person, and then meet the people that have built the bike, because we it's an open door. I don't know many factories where you can just literally show up any day of the week and get a tour and see literally the entire shop or what we're doing. But yeah, we will, that ordering process, and even the wait for your bike is a big deal. I host a weekly stream or live stream on YouTube, and we kind of like Well, I guess one of the things that's kind of neat about our bikes is on the front fender, there's a number plate.
Right.
And that's, you know, traditionally where registration would have lived, but what we've kind of co-opted that and turned it into your serial number. And a lot of people really take a lot of joy in saying, well, I have number 822 of the this. And so when we get on the stream, it's like, you know, where are you coming in from? You know, who are you? What's your bike number? And folks, just, it's really fun to talk about that stuff. And then we have riders in different areas that will get together for a ride. And then we host a yearly rally here at the shop that we can get hundreds of riders to come and join us. And it's really cool for the, it's almost, I think it's more fun for us because our employees, every year we see, it's more of what we've created in one place than we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that the owners will get, we also will, when the bike is being built, we take photographs during the entire process and we'll have an album that we give the customer. So they'll be able to see like their engine being put in their frame, you know, as it's being built, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, I'll bet. Have you ever had anyone come back to you and say, you know, I bought this bike, you know, sort of 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and now I'd like to change the color or, you know, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, we've had that happen a couple of times where somebody will get new color. It's not as common as I think what a lot of owners will do is they start owning more than one and they'll come back for a different model with a different color. We have, well, like on the live stream that I do, there's several guys typically on a Monday night that have three or four spikes on there. Now, that's not super common, of course, but yeah, you could come back and get new tins. One of the things we just launched is a new whole new series of fenders. And we have had a lot of folks coming back and saying, hey, well, I want the ducktail swoop on the back, or I want the polished aluminum or whatever when we launch a new one.
The aesthetics of the bike has got to be a lot of the joy of it. But having said that, I mean, I know you've sort of said, you know, these are not performance machines, but there is a lot to be said. You know, the old adage of, you know, it's more fun to ride a slow bike fast than a fast bike slowly. And just this sort of feeling of yesteryear, you've got, and this is a modern motorcycle, even though it doesn't look like it. And, you know, we've tested enough, you know, Royal Enfields and sort of retro looking motorcycles, the old retro Triumphs and things. In fact, my wife has just bought herself a Royal Enfield. So these do have modern suspension and modern materials. So I'd be willing to bet they actually handle very well. These are light, and I'm sure you can probably ride them pretty briskly and have some fun.
Yes. The adage you mentioned there is absolutely true. I mean, it's the Miata car or the Lotus car or the, you know, it's the idea of what did he say? Speed through lightness, Chapman. The idea that you're because these bikes weigh, the 250 weighs about 275 pounds. Not only does that mean that it accelerates quickly, with a very limited horsepower, you can absolutely keep up with traffic, but the feeling of riding a lightweight, small vehicle is absolutely exhilarating. My motto is anytime anyone offers me to let me take their bike out, which happens a lot owning a motorcycle company, I take them up on it no matter what the weather is. And I've ridden a lot of bikes. I've owned a lot of bikes and I enjoy a 100 horsepower like anybody, you know, it's fun, but for my money, I ride a 250 almost every day. And the enjoyment the reason that I get on a bike, kind of like we were saying earlier, is for that visceral immediate sensation where you feel like you're connected with this machine somehow, and you're able to kind of almost without even meaning to go where you want to go. And that sensation is really distilled, I think, especially on a lightweight machine. And that's true of somewhat heavier bikes too. I think you can find that on a Royal Enfield 350, I'm sure has some of that quality, compared to other motorcycles. They're a little heavier than a Janus, but,
right.
So yeah, that's a big part of of what we're doing. And like you say, you know, these are modern motorcycles. We have to compete against what other manufacturers have out there. So it has to have a comfortable ride. I mean, you don't want to be uncomfortable. You don't want it to break down. That would totally destroy your thrill and fun. And you want it to have that sensation of riding that's really invigorating. So yeah, modern suspension, modern electronics. It's been something that we really take pride on. You know, it's got a functioning 12-volt system, and it's got disc brakes that stop the bike really well. So yeah, it's an interesting bridge, and it kind of gets back to that Roman god who is looking both ways at the same time and kind of holding this kind of threshold where there's a bit of a balance that you're in. And motorcycles, I just think motorcycles are so unique in the world, especially today, because it's a machine that doesn't control you. It doesn't tell you what to do. It can live with you, and you can have this like symbiotic relationship with a motorcycle like you can't have with a phone or now with cars. Even it's almost impossible to understand or service your own vehicle or car these days. And so the motorcycle, it also has to look good. Like, you know, cars don't have to, you know, the brake system doesn't have to look good. Well, on a motorcycle, it has to look good. Yeah. So it's a really unique thing. And what we're trying to do is dig into that more. And we're also trying to kind of like forget about the power, noise, technology race that I feel like maybe since the 80s has sort of distracted us maybe from the fun of motorcycles. So yeah, that's my spiel.
It's a different type of fun. I mean, I'm very familiar with riding, you know, very high horsepower, you know, sport bikes on track. And I've loved it and do love it. But at the same time, my best friend, he owns a couple of Indians from, you know, the 1940s. He's got an ex McQueen Indian Scout and an Indian Chieftain and an Indian Chief. And my goodness, I mean, these things, and they're so complicated to ride. You know, we've got a foot clutch and a hand gear change and the whole thing. And we chunter these things around the local roads around here in Southern California. Honestly, we've had some of the most fun just doing that.
And you got to listen to it and you got to smell it. And there's this whole...
Feel it and the things rattling and banging and clanking away beneath you. But they work extremely well. And there is something about that feeling of being in touch with your environment, and that you literally don't even get that in a convertible car. And you know, you smell the spring blossoms and it's so cliched to say the wind in your hair, because which we don't, because we're all wearing helmets. But there is such a connection to the environment that it really is an experience that once you felt it, there's really second to none. So I can totally see,
absolutely,
I totally get it. Why you have an audience and why you have a customer base. I can definitely see that.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's easy. You know, it's a lot of people
don't even want it to be.
Yeah, yeah. No, you don't. You don't want it to be practical or efficient or you know, comfortable even. And I say that to some people, and they go, "Don't," you know, the sales team's like, "Don't say that." And I say, "Well, hear me out. You know, why you're not riding a motorcycle to get safely to work on time." Like, you know, like, I mean, maybe LA it's faster, but like, you're doing it because it's an activity that transforms you somehow and makes you enjoy it in a different way. So, but it isn't easy, especially with the market the way it is. It's like, you know, a large percentage of people, when they see a Janus, their head just explodes. They don't,
yeah, I can imagine. Like,
you know, it's 14 horsepower. Give me a break. I could, or, you know, $8,000. I could get two Sportsters for that price. And you go, yeah, you could get two Sportsters. Go for it.
Yes. Heck, you could get, you know, you could get eight iPhones for that.
Yeah.
I mean, great. Have at it.
Have at it.
Yeah. I totally get it. But there is a some sort of, as you said, there's a unique relationship between a human being and their motorcycle. What's next for Janus? I mean, I'm sure you've got, your brain is constantly working overtime, and you're sitting there thinking, oh, I wonder what's going to happen, you know, 5 years down the road. I mean,
No, no, I'm waiting to see what happens tomorrow.
Okay. Well, yeah, you and me both. But do you have any sort of, you know, plans to develop something else, or are you just sort of happy just to keep things going as they are?
Oh, yes, we certainly have plans and tricks up our sleeve, not all of which I can talk about. But yeah, we do. We're right now, I think the main thing is staying abreast of the market, seeing what people are interested in. You know, we aren't locked in the 1920s like some people think we are. We're interested in what's happening next, where the mobility scene is going. It'll be interesting to see how we can address that. But for now, really, our focus is going to be spreading the word. We've been around for, what would that be, 13 years? And more people have heard of a Janus, even if they haven't ever seen one. Not everyone has, but we're starting to kind of break in a little bit to the market, and we're interested in trying to figure out how to, well, we just launched a version of all of our models called the Origin line. And the goal with that is to try and figure out how to prepare ourselves for scale and to offer something at a less expensive price point. So one of the ways we do that is trying to limit the number of options, because that's a wonderful thing and we never want to stop being able to do that. But if we can somehow streamline the manufacturing process a little bit, they're still not built on an assembly line, but maybe we can make them a little bit more affordable. And so, yeah, that's been a big win for us a lot. It's been very popular, trying to make them more approachable, I guess, to the average rider. Getting into dealerships is a big focus of us right now. So we're working hard to find a way for people, if they've seen one online, which YouTube is our dealership, or it has been for many years. You can see how they're made, you know, get all the information on them there. But for someone who, like me, would want to see something or test ride it before I spent money on it, trying to figure out how to spread these around. So that's been a big focus. We're doing things like going to Sturgis this year in a big way. We're going to be working with Buffalo Chip for that. I've never been to Sturgis, but I'm excited to experience that. Getting around the country more.
I'm good friends with the COO, Robert Pandia.
Oh, great. Yeah, I was just talking to him a couple of days ago. Yep.
He's a lovely guy. Great guy. He's been around the industry forever, and he's just a great guy. Very creative.
He's been instrumental in getting us involved with Buffalo Chip. He is a big fan of Janus. So yeah, that's been a big focus of ours. And then kind of figuring out how to tell our story to people. And I guess that's a good segue for me to plug this. One of the things that I've been working on the last year is a little book that describes kind of what we've been talking about here, the idea of lightweight motorcycling. And we've decided to call that Rambling. Because I think it's the best word to kind of to describe not necessarily going anywhere to get somewhere, but to enjoy the journey, to soak up as much as you can of life in the process, and maybe come out the other side a little better or different than we started. So yeah, it's a little book. It's about 100 pages, called The Rambler's Companion, or The Art, Practice, and Enjoyment of Lightweight Motorcycling. And it's kind of half treatise and half how-to kind of little guide. It'll fit in your saddlebag, let's say, and you can read it in a sitting. And so I just actually hit the submit button on Amazon publishing about 2 hours ago. So it will be available soon. Check it out on Amazon or on our website, Rambler's Companion. And it digs in. It's a little philosophical, a little poetic, but it digs into kind of the stuff that we've been talking about and helps us talk about what we're doing, helps our owners understand, maybe future owners understand why they might want a Janus or a Royal Enfield or any. It's not particular necessarily to us. It's why you might even want a motorcycle that in this world of Teslas and appliances on wheels.
Yeah, that's absolutely terrific. So presumably, I've seen that you do sort of attend events and that sort of thing. So is there a sort of a Janus, a club or an owner's club or something? And
our Facebook forum is the most popular, much to my chagrin, but I need to liven up our old fashioned forum, but we also do, in-person events. We're starting to do more of those. The biggest one, of course, is the Janus Owners Rally held here in right here at the shop, where we get folks together. But we're working on trying to have more local events, and it's becoming more and more possible because we have multiple bikes in every state at this point. And in big cities like out west, I'm sure in your area, there are many, many Janus that can get together. So,
well, terrific. Well, Richard, it's been lovely talking to you, and I'd love to wish Janus a bright and prosperous future. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.